I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is author Alan First. He's joined in conversation by Judson True. And now join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Alan First and Judson True.
Widely recognized as the master of the historical spy novel, Alan First is the author of the Night Soldiers series, a highly acclaimed series of espionage thrillers set during the advent of World War II when Nazi power was on the rise in Europe. The series includes the best-selling Night Soldiers, The Polish Officer, The Spies of Warsaw, and Mission to Europe, among others, and his novels have been translated into 18 languages. In 2011, Alan received the Peggy V. Helmerich Distinguished Author Award, a literary prize for a body of work. His emotionally gripping and hugely satisfying new novel, A Hero of France, is about the beginnings of the secretive effort to turn the tide against Hitler in German-occupied France. With his unmistakable Firstian polish and depth of historical awareness, he brings Paris and occupied France to life, along with courageous citizens who outmaneuver collaborators, informers, blackmailers, and spies, risking everything to fulfill perilous clandestine missions. Appearing in conversation with Alan this evening is Judson True. Judson currently serves as Chief of Staff to California State Assembly member David Chu. Prior to his career in public service, Judson received a Master's of Journalism from UC Berkeley and graduated with honors from the University of Virginia. Judson is a frequent interviewer for City Arts and lectures and the JCCSF. Ladies and gentlemen, Alan First and Judson True.
Welcome, everyone, and welcome, Alan First, to the JCC.
Thank you.
And we're going to start with a reading tonight.
Yes. This is my most recent book, A Hero of France. Goes on the Times bestseller list at number 7 on Sunday. So that's a good thing. We like that. It is a departure for me. It's quite different than others of my books, which number now 14. All of the others are about the 1930s and about the dynamics and the political dynamics of the 1930s. And I thought when I sat down to write an outline for my publisher, I can't do another one of these. I have to change something. And so I thought, you know, maybe what I'll do is move this ahead from France of the 30s, which was a particular thing, to occupied France. So I began to read about occupied France, and then I began to write about it, and it was like an alchemist dropping some kind of magic pill into a beaker, because it changed everything. Everything changed in 1940 when France was occupied by Nazi Germany. So, it starts with an epigraph that I should read you. I try very hard in the beginning writing them to be clever and smart and cute and lovable and all the rest of it in the epigraph, but then this time I couldn't do it. I had to lay out what was going to go on in this book, and I had to do it in no-nonsense fashion. So it goes. In the spring of 1941, as British bombing raids over Germany intensified, some of the returning aircraft, badly damaged and losing altitude, managed to escape German territory, their pilots and crews parachuting into the occupied zone of France. Here they were hidden until they made contact with small groups of French men and women who had organized escape lines that led out of the country and eventually back to England. This was the beginning of what came to be known as the French Resistance. Now, books are not cheap, but you do get a very nice map here, map of Paris. I know for myself, if I'm in a bookstore and I open a book and there's a map, I'm really ready, you know, ready to read it. That always excites me, the idea of a book that needs a map. It means it's kind of an external book. It's not about somebody's inner life, which I don't really need to read about. There was like, I don't know if it was a cartoon or an observation, but it had to do with two people of the generation that are now in their 20s, and one was saying to the other, "Why?" They were both writing books. And one said to the other, "How come you're not writing a memoir?"
It's amazing that they were writing books at all.
Well, yeah, that's true. Nombrilisme, the French call it, navel gazing. So not only do you get one map in here, look, you get two. The second one, being north central France in 1941, and as the RAF bombers came down from their nighttime raids against the Ruhr and Essen and the Krupp people, they came down in a southeasterly direction, and that's where the pilots ran out of gas, or the pilot died. The Wellington bomber had room for only a pilot, so if he were killed, that was it. Everybody else had to jump out. Sometimes they were just damaged and managed somehow to make it as far as France. Sometimes there was a headwind and they'd used up their fuel. A million reasons that planes go down. And this shows Paris, Senlis, Beaumont-sur-Oise, Aubergenville, Rouen, Lavre, Deauville. This is really the area where the parachute people came down. And when they came down, they were instructed to find the village priest. And once they found the village priest, he would be at the head end of one of these escape lines. So the first chapter is called, and it has to do with an occupied country, it has to do with relations, street relations, between occupiers and occupied. And it's called, "You Must Not Meet Their Eyes." And I'll read a little bit of it, just a couple of pages. Occupied Paris, the 10th day of March, 1941. At 8:20 in the evening, the man known to his resistance cell as Mathieu waited in a doorway where he could watch the entry of the metro station on the boulevard Richard Lenoir. He tried to look beyond the entry at the tree-lined boulevard, but there wasn't much to be seen. Only shapes in the night. The street lamps had been painted blue, and the windows of apartment buildings draped or shuttered in the blackout ordered by the German occupation authority. A sad thing, he thought, a dark and silent city. Silent because the Germans had forbidden the use of cars, buses, and taxis. But in that silence, nightingales could be heard singing in the parks, and in that darkness, the streets were lit by silvery moonlight when the clouds parted. A night earlier at the same metro, Mathieu had noticed a gray bicycle bound to the trunk of a chestnut tree by a stout chain. Now he saw that it was still there. Bicycles had never been more valuable, and soon enough this one would be stolen if its owner did not retrieve it. Where was he? What had happened to him? In a cell at some police prefecture? Possibly. But if the Paris police arrested you, friends or family would be notified and someone would have come for the bicycle. Maybe its owner was floating in the Seine, a bad fate, but not the worst fate. The worst fate was to be taken by the Gestapo. And if that were so, he might never be heard of again. Nacht und Nebel, night and fog, Hitler's very own invention. People disappeared, and nobody would ever find out what had become of them. They went out to do an errand and never returned. A sharp lesson for family and friends, punished forever by their imaginations. Now the ground trembled beneath Matthew's feet, and he could hear a rumble from down below as the train pulled into the station. Moments later, the passengers appeared, climbing up the stairway to the boulevard. They were still wearing winter clothes because it was cold in the city, apartments and offices barely heated for want of coal. As the crowd emerged, one woman caught his eye. She was lovely to look at, the face of a fallen angel, and dressed in the latest Paris fashion. She wore ski pants, warmer than a skirt, a ski jacket, and boots. She was lucky to have the boots. Some passengers wore clogs, wood-soled shoes, as there was no leather to be had for repair. To Matthew, the passengers looked tired and worn. They might well have looked like that at the end of a working day before the war, but for Matthew, the weariness was different, deeper. Lately, one heard the expression, "Je suis las." It meant, "I am tired of the way I have to live my life." And this was what Matthew saw in their faces, in the way they walked. But then he would think that he cared for the people of Paris as though he were a guardian. The woman in the ski jacket returned his look, a glance, nothing flirtatious, rueful perhaps. Ah, at last. Here was Lisette, 17 years old, a lycée student. She appeared not to notice him, but as she walked past the doorway, she said, her voice low and confidential, "They have crossed the border. They're in Spain." Thank you. I'm sorry. I'm on the 17th day of a book tour, and I have a nice call to take home with me tomorrow.
It sounds almost as challenging as running the escape lines.
I'll tell you, it is challenging.
Well, one thing about this book, you said at the beginning that it's different than your other books, and one quick, obvious difference is the title. I think in all the previous books in the Night Soldier series, which you've called many chapters, now 14 chapters of one very long book,
they
all have titles that are, let's say, a little more depressing than this current one. I'd say they all have heroes, but this is the first time that the word hero appears in the title. What is that about?
I wanted to be more direct than I had been, you know? And I thought, what is this person? What is this character? And then I thought, he's a hero. And he's a hero in a lot of different ways. He's a hero in that he's a leader in this resistance effort, but he's also a hero in other ways. He saves his people. He protects his people. And again in the book, he does what might not be called heroic actions, but in fact were actions of decency as much as actions of bravery.
Mm-hmm. And was it something different about heroism when the war has actually started as opposed to the lead up to the war, which is when most of the other books take place or the bulk of the action in other books take place?
Absolutely. France fell in 1940 in June. And for about 9 months, the French did absolutely nothing. They were in shock. They didn't know what to do. Finally, in the spring of 1941, some rather upper middle class people who knew each other, who were families or who worked together, got together and started to work on these escape lines, taking the British airmen down to Spain, to Lisbon, and to England.
Why was it so important to get those British soldiers out of, or British airmen out of France? I mean, why did the French care so much about these individual British airmen?
Well, this was not an act of humanity. As it says in the book, 1941 was not a humane year. In fact, these people were weapons. A trained bomber pilot in 1941 was a weapon. There weren't all that many of them. And the British were losing 5-10% per night raid. Wasn't going to last a long time that way. In the RAF fighter pilots, there were maybe 600. And these are not people that are produced overnight. And that's equally true of bombardiers, navigators, radio people, etc. So what they were doing was these weapons were being taken back to England where they could fight again.
And one of the striking things about the book and about all your books is all the just incredible population of characters that you conjure up. And some of them are just there for a few pages and they stick with you as much as the heroes. How did you come up with that approach, and why is that important to your work?
I like to sketch. If you're a writer, you tend to gravitate towards what you see yourself as being good at. And I'm good at a few strokes. There's a character in this book. The first people that the British Secret Services sent over to France in clandestine landings on the beaches of what would be the Normandy invasion, they sent in instructors to teach people how to blow up a railway track. Not every Frenchman knew how to blow up a railroad track. So they had to be taught. And one of them is a former colonial policeman from what we now know as Vietnam. He doesn't call them Annamese. He calls them Indochinese. And he was a colonial policeman in Indochina. And it says of him that he had a certain kind of very hard face. And then it says he was not someone you would stop on the street to ask for directions. That's it. I don't have to say any more than that. You know exactly what I mean. And you know a lot about him at that point.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the other threads that this book carries through is the strength of your female characters. It wasn't just Matthew. It was you introduced the young student,
Lisa,
and then there's Chantal and others. Talk a little bit about the women in this book, and then maybe tie it to the women that populate your earlier books.
Well, these were strong women, and they did lead resistance cells. By 1941, France had lost a lot of their males in World War I, which was a brutal, terrible business. And they'd lost even more into concentration camps in the fighting that ended on June 10th, 1940. And that left a lot of these strong women to take over and run things, which they did and did brilliantly. The position of women in France that year was women did not get the vote until 1944. A woman in 1941 who wanted a driver's license, or 1940, and wanted a driver's license would have to get a letter from her husband. But they came forward and led many of these efforts.
And of course, the other role that the women, that characters in this book play, her name is Joelle
Emperor
of France, is the romantic backdrop. And one of the things that's really striking, I think, about all of your work is how this dark atmosphere of the impending war and all of the just the sort of threat of violence coexists with romance. How important is it to you to have that element of romance in your books, and how accurate is that part historically?
It's crucial. We're living in a world in 1941 France when there was very damn little pleasure to be had. In other words, there was no food, it was cold. You couldn't wash your clothes because the soap was no good. You couldn't wash your dishes because the soap was no good. In all that misery, there was love between two people, physical love. And that was a crucial consolation. You know, I like to think of it as an island of consolation in a sea of misery. People did do that, and that was helped on, I think, by the serious possibility that you wouldn't live to see the end of this thing. People did not, you know, this idea we have only tonight, They believed that, and sometimes with cause believed it.
You're listening to author Alan First, whose latest novel is A Hero of France. He's joined in conversation by Judson True on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Let's talk a little bit about the resistance. How did the resistance proceed over the course of the war, and where do you take us in the book in terms of the progression of it?
There were three phases to the French resistance. The first phase started in the spring of 1941, very tepid. A few university professors had distributed anti-Nazi leaflets, for which they were promptly put in jail and I think eventually sent to concentration camps and died there. A few other people, upper middle class people who knew each other and who trusted each other, started to work to help the British flyers to get out of France. This until June 21st, 1941, when Hitler invaded the USSR. This liberated the French Communist Party. The French Communist Party were dying to fight the Germans, but they'd been told by the Comintern they were not allowed to do that, that they should consider the conflict between Germany and England as a colonial war. But once Hitler's divisions crossed, Barbarossa, a million men, crossed into the Ukraine, Stalin took the gloves off, and now you had some very tough guys in the French Communist Party. These were tough union guys. They had guns. They knew how to use them. They didn't mind using them. They didn't mind if they had to put somebody out of the way that 100 hostages would be shot in return. They thought that was okay. Basically, it would make 100 families support them. And this went on. This was the period of blowing up railway tracks, of disrupting communications by knocking down telephone poles and whatnot. And then there came the third phase, which was preparation for Normandy. And then everybody got involved. There's a story about a geographer in France who drew a 60-foot-long map on brown butcher paper. 60 feet is a long map. It had every cove, every sand dune, every rock, every indentation of the shoreline. I really often wondered where the hell that is today. I don't think you can get it on eBay. And I wonder if it survived the war.
Where did you see the reference to it? Where did that come
from? In one of the many, 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 many books I read.
Yeah. Well, research. Your work, I think, is... I think romance and research are two R's that kind of go together there. Where did your passion for research come from, and how do you dive that deep into this period?
Research is very addicting. It's curious. I was never that kind of person. I was always considered to be a kind of lazy student. But then all of a sudden, I got interested in something, and that changed. And the more I did of it, the more I liked it, and I discovered that I couldn't really exactly write a novel. I surely couldn't write a plot. But then I thought, I'm going to allow history to be the novelist here. It's a much better novelist than the novelist. You know, novelists make up things, and you can tell in the book when something is being artificially created, some kind of device. I don't do that. I can't do it. Much better for me to write out the history and to use the characters as part of the events that happened during the history. And then the research became very esoteric. I wrote a book about the Dutch called Dark Voyage. And to write about the Dutch, of course, you have to write about a sea captain. What else? Especially during the era of convoys. And I am the proud owner of Brown's Nautical Almanac, 1936. It's terrific. If you're in Sag Harbor, stop by. I'll show it to you. It's quite thoroughly wonderful. And it was really difficult for me. I had to learn all kinds of technology of the 1930s freighter. I knew nothing about this. In fact, I went down to Baltimore, where they have a Liberty ship called the John Y. Brown, in order to figure out where the captain stood on the deck and where the helmsman stood on the deck. I had no idea of the space relation there. And it was just an amazing experience to try to work that out. I managed, but it was very, very difficult. Anyhow, I didn't mind either, because it was like knowing something that nobody else knew, and that's always cool.
Yeah, and why the 30s and the lead up to World War II? What is it about that particular period, which is just before the sort of lifetimes of many people today, like that, what about that period grabbed you?
The world exploded in the 30s. I don't know why. It may have had something to do with the Depression. I'm sure it did, but you get the ascent of Hitler in 1933, 1934, 1935, purges in the USSR, 1936, 1938, Spanish Civil War, passionately idealistic, at least on the Republican side. 1936, 1938, Spanish Civil War. 1938, Munich, the Czechs are betrayed. 1939, Poland invaded. 1940, France and the Low Countries invaded. 1941, Germany attacks the Soviet Union. At the same time, there was some kind of spirit loose. You can hear it in the music. If you listen to Django Reinhardt, if you listen to Duke Ellington, if you listen to the music of the period, Samuel Barber's Adagio, if you like classical music, if you can bear it. It was incredible. They don't do things like that now. They don't make movies like Casablanca now. Look at the movies that were made in 1939, and you'll just be knocked out at the creative vigor and range of it. So in the end, I don't exactly know why, but you can see it. If you can see the black and white movies, you can this spirit caught on fire, and it ended with the Second World War, and then it ended in 45. And then we sort of slid down into the 50s.
As a historical expert on the 30s and the beginning of World War II, do you think that people made really tremendous mistakes that led to the war, or do you have a feeling of inevitability about it as a student of the period?
People made tremendous mistakes. Hitler should have been crushed like a bug and wasn't. And there was plenty of opportunity to do that. When he marched into the Rhineland in 1936, the French did nothing. They advanced 10 yards. They were to come to regret that. The United States was self-obsessed after the Depression. Americans wanted no part of what they thought of as European squabbles, so we stayed out of it. In 1939, 1938, Jews attempting to try to find a place to live. There was a conference at Evian-les-Bains in France. No Jews were taken in by any country. They were suspected of God knows what. But America was very, very self-involved at that point until 1941 and Pearl Harbor. That's the only thing that changed it.
As you lived in Paris for a while, is
long
that right?
Long time, yes.
How, as an American living in Paris and traveling in Europe, how important was that to your emergence as a writer? Do you think you would have been the writer you are without living in Paris?
Oh, no. No way. Living in Paris made all the difference in the world. I don't entirely understand why, but I was surrounded by it. I was taking it in by osmosis. I was living in Europe. Europe was part of me, part of every day. And more, I mean, I used to ride the metro, and I would look at the faces in the metro, and I would go, these are not Americans. These are French people. They look different. They hold themselves in a different way. They have a different history. And I became fascinated by that, and I thought, I'm not interested in much in writing about Americans. I'm interested in writing about Europeans. And proceeded to do so.
And how much of a sense did you develop when you lived in Paris of the differences between, say, some of the Eastern European countries? You have major characters from, obviously, Russia and then Bulgaria. How did you develop those sorts of instincts?
By happenstance. Paris is a place that everybody tries to go. And where there were plenty of starving Russians and emigre Bulgarians and what have you. And they were the ones who were trying to make it to the heart of Europe and somehow create a new life. And they're different looking people. And they're different in what they say and they're different in the way they dress. But remember, Eastern Europe had a long history of being under communist domination, which didn't end till 1989, till the wall came down. I had a couple of friends, both of whom won Pulitzers, writing for the New York Times, and talking about Poland. They said that when you were in a room with a Pole, if the gesture was this, pointing at the ceiling, which meant we're being taped. And it was life, you know, life under that kind of focus. When I went to Moscow to start an article for Esquire magazine in 1983, I saw for the first time a police state. I had never seen that before, and I went crazy. I mean, it was not subtle. It was very, very overt, and I didn't like it. It's just a horrible way to treat people. And you could see from the people in the street with the shadows under their eyes and in the way they looked that they suffered for it.
Mm-hmm. In addition to being, you know, the expert on the 30s and World War II, obviously espionage is your, you know, central focus. Now, of course, the spy thrillers are, for the most part, if they're not set back in the Cold War, are about, you know, the fight against terrorism. And
right.
How do you think that the modern world of the spy, either novel or television show, because so much more is television now, how do you think that differs from what you're doing in your books, and how do you see those cultural products?
I think in my books it was the end of a period of where spying was a human thing. In other words, it had to do with people having lunch together. It had to do with one human knowing another human. It had to do with a human who couldn't tolerate the political situation in their country anymore, or a human who was greedy and wanted money. Now, I think it's incredibly technical. It's all up there and up there.
All the satellite, but farther up.
Yeah.
Than in Poland.
Well, yeah, you know, drones and whatnot.
Yeah.
I mean, And I think people feel helpless in a way. You can't not be seen, noticed, tracked, filmed, recorded. Shrug. I don't really know what, if anything, you can do about it. But back then that wasn't true. Now they did have some technology. They had the good cameras, the Minox cameras. They had microdots. You know, a period in a sentence could hold all kinds of information. But basically, it was a human-to-human thing at the time I'm writing about.
Do you watch or read any of the sort of contemporary spy?
Le Carré.
Because
he's so good.
What about Homeland on television? Have you ever seen that?
No, I've never seen that.
They still have lunch in that.
Oh, do they?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I don't. I mean, I know there's a lot on television, but I fear I don't watch much of it.
Yeah. And how about Europe? Do you still travel in Europe?
I don't. I'm rusticated.
Yeah.
I live in this little village on Long Island, perfectly happy, quite secluded, quite reclusive. It's a village. And if I go to the post office, I'm there for 20 minutes because I know all the people. And everybody talks to everybody else, and they meet at the post office, or they meet at the grocery store. I happen to really like that way of living. I was born and raised in Manhattan, which is now to me a horror. It's loud, aggressive, and scary. That's the way I find it. Meanwhile, I haven't been back to Europe because the Europe that I knew, even the Europe that I dreamed about, no longer exists. So, I mean, it's still a good place to go. I'm sure you should all go, but I don't.
Do you write at home in a studio, or how do you? What's your?
I used to write in a studio. Now I write in an office in my house. I write on a typewriter. I don't think a computer is a good thing to write on. You don't really own it. It doesn't exactly do what you want. It's liable to pop up and do something at any moment. You go, I'm writing a novel here. Get out of my face. I can't stand it. I mean, I write email, and yes, I do all the contemporary things, but I got to tell you that a lot of writers that I know write with yellow legal pads and a pencil. That's a good way to write. You know, you're right there. But I like to hit an E and have a nice loud clack as the... You know, as the key hits the paper and I look at the paper and lo and behold, there's an E. On the other hand, if I'm at my computer and I tap the E, with Bill Gates' permission, a kind of ghostly E emerges from the ether. It's a very different experience, that's all I can say, but it's probably just me.
So you wrote a number of books that were very different before you sort of had this epiphany and moved to the historical espionage novel. What was that transition like, or what happened there, and how do you look back on that part of your career now?
Oh, it was terrible. I wrote the worst books. 29 years old, you have no business writing novels. But what happened was I was on unemployment insurance, living in a farm in Bowlesburg with my wife and my Irish wolfhound. And I ran out of murder mysteries to read. I was a great fan of John D. MacDonald, you know, Travis McGee and all that. Loved that stuff. Couldn't get enough. But also couldn't afford it. And I'd read pretty much whatever the library had. And I said to my wife, you know, I counted words and pages in one of these things. And if I write 5 pages a day for 40 days, I'll have 200 pages, and that's a novel. And I'm sure that if I send it out to one of the cheapo paperback publishers, I'll get $800 for it. And if I do that 5 times a year, we can live. Naive, but that's what I thought. So I proceeded to do that, and I wrote a really awful book called Your Day in the Barrel, and couldn't sell it, tried for 2.5 years, sent it out to Ace Books and Charter Books and whatnot. And then eventually, in 2.5 years, Patrick Knopf, who was the son of Alfred Knopf, who started Knopf, and his publishing house, Athenaeum, bought it. And my response to that was, what the hell is this all about? I had not ever anticipated that. And I thought, I wonder if I'm a writer. It seems entirely possible from this. I proceeded to write 2 more of these honeys. They were about a dope dealer from Great Neck, Long Island, named Roger Levin, a sort of wise guy from a reasonably wealthy home, who was in the marijuana business. Awful books. I then proceeded to write a bad spy novel, contemporary, called Shadow Trade. And this was taken almost wholeheartedly from a movie called The Conversation with Gene Hackman. Good movie.
Set here in San Francisco.
Book. Yes, that's right.
With Gene. Union Square? Is that the scene? Is it in Union Square?
I think so.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, no, so it was a terrific movie, but it gave birth to an atrocious book.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features author Alan First, whose latest novel is A Hero of France. He's joined in conversation by Judson True. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So, I don't know how many more of these I could have published. I had various publishers. I published at Athenaeum, as I said, Doubleday, Delacorte, Delacorte. And then I went to Russia, went to Moscow, had that particular experience in the Soviet Union and coming up the Danube, and I changed completely. And I wrote a book called Night Soldiers, which was a doorstop, as they say, a doorstop because I thought a historical novel had to be at least 2 inches. That's what I understood a historical novel to be. It was packed. It had a lot of history in there. But it's a good book, and it continues to be one of my more popular books. It's about a young Bulgarian fisherman from Rus, Bulgaria, and his being taken into the NKVD in something like 1934. Eventually, he's sent to Spain to run operations against the Republicans or whoever. And he defects, he goes to Paris, he goes to jail, he has just endless things happen to him because I thought I had to get to 1945. So it's a much longer book than it needs to be because I thought I'll never write another one of these. That turned out not to be true.
That book has a scene that I think is probably the most moving that I've read in your work, which is when a certain someone disappears and he's looking for a trace of her in the room. Do you remember writing that scene where he's looking for Alexandra?
Yes.
And he does find a trace of her.
Yes.
But never sees her alive again.
Yes.
Not to give it away.
Not to give it away, but I have to say the literature of the people who were ground up by the Russian special services is particularly sad.
Mm-hmm. I think one thing about a spy novel is I think a lot of people think there's got to be a ton of action. How do you think through the action versus the history and the psychology? What balance are you seeking there?
I know that I am required to produce a certain amount of action. But strange, over the years in writing about it, I've become averse to violence. I hate writing about it now. It makes me feel bad. I don't think that's so unnatural, but I do read books which are wildly, terribly violent, and it disturbs me. I won't watch movies like that. I don't like books like that. But, alas, or whatever, when I do have to do it, I find that I do it reasonably well. And that doesn't necessarily make me happy, but I try to do everything in a book reasonably well, whether it's a romantic scene or it's a train ride, whatever it is. Ditto the violence. But I know I have like some kind of meter in my head, and I know when it's time to change the scene and have something happen.
One thing I was going to ask you about when we were talking about World War II, obviously the 30s, the rise of fascism. We're at a moment in our country a little bit where around both here and in Europe, the word fascism is getting thrown around again as something that we're seeing. What do you think? Are we in a sort of proto-fascist moment? Or
the world is in some difficulty. That's what I think. That's what my friends think. That's what we talk about. What you have is a growing right-wing anger, frustration, very unhealthy. You have what they call income inequality, a lot of rich people, too many poor people, too much anger, too many people blocked from doing things. You read about a segment of the electorate, which is white, young white males without college degrees who can't get a job. This is really unhealthy for a democracy. We all know this. And what happens when you get this kind of thing is what used to be called the man on horseback, the man who's going to gallop in and save the day. And this goes on all over Europe, Hungary, Austria, several of the states in Eastern Europe have swung to the right because people are afraid that immigrants are going to come and take their jobs. Immigrants are going to come and take their houses. And they are people of nations who have resisted outsiders forever. Europe is very, what is that word? They really don't like foreigners.
The xenophobia.
They're xenophobic. I'll tell you a story about French xenophobia. When I was a Fulbright teaching fellow in 69-70 in the south of France, we had a friend named Edwin Hackney, who had been at the University of Kentucky and was now some kind of a special assistant in the English department. And Edwin had no money and found a kind of a garage refitted into a single-room studio, and it was owned by a woman that he referred to as Madame. And Madame was the figure in his life. Madame did this, Madame did that. One day, Madame was wildly upset. What was wrong? Her daughter was going to marry an étranger, which means stranger in French, but it's a very strong word. Much stronger than stranger in English. Well, who was the étranger? Well, we thought about it. Could he be Senegalese? Could he be African? Could he be Algerian? Who was he? So finally, about 2 months later, Edwin got up the nerve to ask her because the wedding was fast approaching. And Edwin said, Madame, your daughter is still getting married, right? Yes, she is. And Edwin said, well, the étranger she's marrying, who is he? And she looked at him, and anger and hatred filled her face. And she said, il est de Béziers. Béziers 14 miles away from there. That's the way Europe is, I mean, for better or for worse.
Well, on that hopeful note, why don't we open up to audience questions?
I think that'd
Thank
be
you
nice.
Very much, Alan First.
My pleasure. Please ask questions.
If we have read all of your books many, many times, so we need a little break, odd though that might be. Are there any other novelists writing in that genre of that period that you recommend, that you like?
I like Olivia Manning really well. I can't think of the titles of her books. She wrote a trilogy, the first of which is really good and really interesting. And Lord help me, you'll see from reading my books, you know, that she's someone quite akin to me. And she has a certain way of talking about this period, and she tells a great story. I think the first book is located among British diplomatic personnel in Romania. I would recommend to you also, of course, Eric Ambler, Coffin for Demetrius, which is a most extraordinary book. He wrote it in 38, and it's like he had vision into the future. It's really strange. It's an incredible book. It's the book that got me started writing this kind of novel that I write. I have a copy of Coffin for Demetrius, and on the inside of the white, it's a paperback, on the inside of the white page at the very back, is the first paragraph of Night Soldiers. I would recommend that to you. Graham Greene, we could discuss that. I mean, I don't really like him all that much until you get to Our Man in Havana. But Our Man in Havana is really funny, and I do recommend that to you, and very, very engrossing. Some of his other books are a little too moral for my taste. Who else? Well, after that, it gets very esoteric, so I'll leave you with those three possibilities.
I know that Olivia Manning, I've seen it in that New York Review of Books.
You have?
In print. Yeah, it's called The Balkan Trilogy.
The Balkan Trilogy.
That's a good doorstop.
It is a good doorstop, yeah. But it's also a very good book. She's terrific.
Hi, my name is Susan. I just wondered, this may be sort of simplistic, but where do you think this idea of someone is going to come take away our, some foreigner is going to come take away our jobs? Is this something from way back when or started recently? And obviously it's by, I think, people, the 1% maybe? That might be oversimplified.
I don't honestly know. I think it's a very old idea. I think in these countries with a weakly protected working class, people are worried about their jobs because they've seen other people's jobs disappear. I suppose there was a time when if you were the blacksmith or the shoemaker, you were the only person that had that skill. But if you work in some kind of a carpet factory in Budapest, the next thing you might hear is that the carpets are now going to be made in Japan or in China. Refugees from the Middle East, and this is causing all kinds of hell in Europe. It really, really is. It's very hard to absorb the number of people now in flight from these horrific terrorist wars that are going on in Syria. People don't know what to do. They attempt to preserve their lives, the lives of their children and their wives. They're blameless. They're not terrorists. They happen to be Syrian. And they need to be protected. But it's a good question, who's able to protect them and who's able to take in, absorb this many people in this day and age?
Forgive me for asking. The relationship between the aging process and writing, does it get easier or more difficult? Does it get more satisfying or less satisfying? And
it,
so on.
It's scary. I keep worrying that at a certain point you lose it. And I keep thinking, I fear that I'm going over the top of the sine wave and coming down the other side. But it hasn't happened yet. And I don't know when it will happen. Ultimately, it will. I one time read a book by, I can't remember his name, James M. Cain, who wrote The Postman Always Rings Twice. Well, they brought him back out of retirement, and he wrote a book, God help us, it was like terrible. It was about biography. And the hero of the book was a biographer. And he had a big chest and was known by the nickname Brisket. Did no one come to this poor man's aid? No, they took the book and published it because of his name and people bought it. And this happens all the time. So yeah, I expect it will be my turn. But it isn't, I mean... In response to this, I have a very good agent, the best agent in the business. And when I've said things like this, she said to me, not yet. Like, I'll tell you when. It's a good question, by the way.
You write about diplomats and people who intersect, particularly the one in Hungary, I think of as essentially a lot, very political. But for the most part, you avoid politics in a very political, military environment. Is that all deliberate, not to tangle into politics very directly?
Absolutely. When I read about it, I've got to spend forever figuring it out. And if when I read histories, contemporary histories of the time, and they start talking about, you know, the French, they had the Parti Radical, and then they had this, and then they had Leon, whoever it was, and so on and so forth. You can't tell the players without the scorecard, and I'm really not going to try to take the reader through that. That's teaching, and that's something I don't do. So what it does is it makes these books somewhat erroneous in many ways, but at least they're fine. And once you start down that road, it's impossible to get back. In fact, French politics in the 1930s is very, very complicated. The one book which does something with that is Mission to Paris, which is a book about political warfare and how the German Foreign Office, using hundreds of millions of 1930s dollars, destroyed France before it ever fought a day. And I thought that was a fascinating story. It was a story I didn't know. I unearthed it in some book that I had holding something up in my bedroom. And I used to pass it every morning and think, well, I wonder what that is. I wonder what that is. And one day I read it, and it was a treasure. And this is the story it told. It told the story of how the newspapers were owned by political parties. If you think about it a minute, that's a really bad idea. And it was a bad idea in America for a long time. That's changed somewhat. And these newspapers were used as weapons against opposition political leaders. We have a bit of that now, you know. We didn't used to have quite so much of it. There used to be a sort of doctrine of fairness. Not now. And I think it's bad for a democracy when you have partisan media. Very bad.
Now, fair is a code word.
I'm sorry?
Fair is a code word, fair and balanced. It's not,
yeah.
It's not really what it says it is.
Well, yeah, but it tried so hard for so long. You know, the Times, New York Times, was so ponderous about it, trying to get it right, trying not to lean too far this way or lean too far that way. The Times still tries that, but it's been, you know, been attacked as a liberal left newspaper, which I don't think it is. And that climate, once you read about it in the France of 1930s, you really see what happened and how it happened and how it led to the downfall of a country before a shot was ever fired.
Thank you very much, Alan First.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was author Alan First, whose latest novel is A Hero of France. He was joined in conversation by Judson True. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espelet. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.